Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host today, Dave Allen. Melody off taking care of some other business. For all your gold and silver needs, you can call her toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day for Tuesday, October 10 already, 2023. Hey, happy World Mental Health Day, a day that's intended to raise awareness and mobilize efforts to support mental health, which is a hot topic. And hey, that's good news. It means the stigma for mental health issues slowly going away. The mental health issues are finally getting the attention they deserve, in fact. Healthcare workers and individuals feel they can discuss mental health more openly, and individuals are seeing therapists for issues regarding their mental health more than ever before. However, that doesn't mean that there still isn't work to do. As a whole, we still often misunderstand mental health because, well, it's hard to define. Additionally, mental health includes a lot of areas. These areas involve one, social, emotional, and psychological well-being. Our mental health affects our thoughts, feelings, and actions. When we have positive mental health, we handle stress better, our productivity is stable, and we set ourselves up to realize our full potential. So here's to Mental Health Awareness Day. Let's move on to today's market report. Well, it tried. Gold and silver, roughly flat today. Gold holding steady, down 90 cents, $1,861 an ounce. Silver down about a quarter of a percent, 6 cents at $21.90. Platinum down a little bit more, half a percent, at $891. Palladium actually up 4%, $45 at $1,193 on a down U.S. dollar day. Markets, on the other hand, well, I mean, they were, particularly the stocks, equities were way up earlier. They've since come down. Dow Jones closing up about 135 points at 33,739. NASDAQ up 78 plus points, 13,563 roughly. And the broader S&P 500 up 22 points, about 0.5%, all of them at 4,358. And as I had alluded, the U.S. dollar index was actually down about 0.25% today at 105.77. All treasury yields were down fairly substantially today. 10-year yield at 4.65. 5-year. I'm sorry, the 2-year down about 4.96. That's getting closer. That inverted yield curve, the 2 to 10-year anyway, is getting a tad tighter. 3-month still holding above 5 at 5.49, but still narrowing. Somewhat. We'll talk more about interest rates, mortgage rates in just a little bit. Oil also down today, about 60 cents a barrel, $85.79. Natural gas still going up another 0.5% today, $3 and we'll call it 40 cents. And let's see, anything else of interest? Now we'll hold it there. The VIX volatility index down about 3.5% today. Sitting about 1705, a little higher than it's been over the past couple of months. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's market report brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Things are, we'll call them crazy in the Middle East, parts of the Middle East today, although Israel's military said that it has regained effective control over its south and the border with the Gaza Strip. That comes 4 days after Hamas fighters stormed into the country and brought gun battles to its streets and literally inside Israeli homes for the first time in several decades. Israel's declaration came as the Israeli Defense Forces sought to make good on the government's vow to hunt down the militants and intensify an assault on densely populated Gaza, which is the Palestinian territory ruled by Hamas and home to 2 million people. Conflict has already killed hundreds, in fact, over 1,000 on both total on both sides. Israel's military said more than 900 people have died, including a dozen or so Americans, since Saturday's incursion in Gaza and the West Bank. A reported 765 people have been killed. And in Israel and beyond, the families of more than 150 people kidnapped by Hamas and other militant groups feared for the lives of their loved ones. The armed wing of Hamas has warned it will kill one of the hostages every time Israel's military bombs civilian targets in Gaza without warning. I haven't heard anything to suggest that they have gone through with those threats, given Israel's ongoing strikes there. Also expanded, it called up 360,000 military reservists today. The military emphasized the unprecedented nature of this campaign against Hamas, saying all options are on the table. The military said it struck hundreds of Hamas targets overnight in Gaza. Tens of thousands of residents fled their homes as these relentless airstrikes literally leveled buildings, including in Gaza City's residential and commercial district of Ramal. Along with bombarding downtown Gaza City, Israeli airstrikes also targeted the crossing between Egypt and the city of Rafah in southern Gaza, the only passage out of that territory. Over 137,000 Palestinians were said to be packed into UN shelters already. And the World Health Organization has reported the medical supplies it had pre-positioned in 7 hospitals in Gaza were already used up. Leo Kanz, who heads Doctors Without Borders for the Palestinian territories, said he was concerned the humanitarian medical group's team in Gaza would soon run out of medical supplies now that the enclave's borders have closed. Said he was particularly concerned about the supply of surgical equipment, bandages, antibiotics, and fuel. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared in a televised announcement that the offense against Hamas in the Gaza Strip has only started. What we will do to our enemies in the coming days will reverberate with them for generations. Wow, the plot there certainly thickens. Back here in the States, top real estate and banking officials are calling on the Federal Reserve to stop raising interest rates as the industry suffers through surging housing costs and a historic shortage of available homes for sale. In a letter addressed to the Fed Board of Governors and its chair, Jerome Powell, the officials voiced their worries about the direction of monetary policy and the impact it's having on the beleaguered real estate market. Coalition of the National Association of Home Builders, the Mortgage Bankers Association, and the National Association of Realtors said they wrote the letter, quote, to convey profound concern shared among our collective memberships that ongoing market uncertainty about the Fed's rate path is contributing to interest rate hikes and volatility, unquote. The groups asked the Fed to not contemplate further rate hikes and not to actively sell its holdings of mortgage-backed securities, at least until the housing market has stabilized. The group said, we urge the Fed to take these steps to ensure that this sector doesn't precipitate the hard landing the Fed has tried so hard to avoid. Housing sector has been in a recession for some time. The letter comes as the Fed is weighing how it should proceed with monetary policy after raising its benchmark Fed funds rate 11 times since March last year. In recent days, a number of its officials have noted that the Fed could be in a position to hold off on further increases as they assess the impact of the previous ones have had. Oh, all right. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, some technical issues, I believe, with my microphone. Apologize. At recent meetings, Powell has acknowledged dislocations in the housing market. During his July news conference, for example, he noted this will take time to work through. Hopefully, more supply comes online. Well, with the average 30-year mortgage rate now just shy of 8%, and the average home price climbing to over $407,000, the available inventory at the equivalent of 3.3 months, realtors estimate that inventory would literally need to double to bring prices down. Whew. It's getting pretty hairy out there. Well, two Fed officials did suggest that the Fed may leave interest rates unchanged at its next meeting in 3 weeks. They said a surge in long-term interest rates has made borrowing more expensive, no duh, and could help cool inflation without further action. Now, since late July, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note has jumped from around 4% to, as high as over 4.8, a 16-year high. The run-up in the yield has inflated other borrowing costs out there and raised the national average 30-year mortgage rate to almost 8%, as I just mentioned. That's the highest in 23 years. Business borrowing costs have also risen as corporate bond yields have accelerated. Vice Chair of the Fed Board and a close ally of Jerome Powell, Phil Jefferson, said in a speech to the National Association for Business Economics that he would remain cognizant of the higher bond rates and keep that in mind as I assess the future path of policy. His comments followed a speech to the NABE earlier in the day by Lori Logan, who's the president of the Dallas Fed and who is a voting member of the Fed's rate-setting Federal Open Market Committee. She also indicated that higher long-term bond rates could help serve the Fed's efforts to slow inflation to its 2% target. She added, if long-term interest rates do remain elevated because investors are increasingly concerned about the risk of holding long-term bonds, there may be less need to raise the Fed funds rate. As we know, bond rates rise when investors find them riskier to buy or hold. And last Thursday, Mary Daly, who's president of the San Francisco Fed, said that if longer-term interest rates remain high, the need for us to take further action is diminished. CME future markets have priced in only a 12% chance of a rate hike at the Fed's November meeting, 26% in December, significantly lower on Friday when the government's latest surprisingly robust jobs report was released. Fed officials have not pushed back against those expectations in their recent remarks, a sign they may not disagree with them at the moment. Logan did note that if longer-term rates are rising mostly because investors expect the economy to grow more quickly in the future, well, the Fed might have to keep lifting the short-term rate to cool the economy further. But analysts increasingly think that the 10-year rate is rising because investors see greater volatility in inflation and the economy and consider holding longer-term bonds to be more risky. Hold on to your hats. The headwinds are still blowing hard. Hey, if you think Treasury yields are high these days, well, take a look at mortgage rates. As we mentioned, the interest rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage, which is the second most relevant price in the American economy, after only the price of gas, looks like it's going to hit 8% sooner rather than later. It's a rate we haven't seen in over 23 years. Last time mortgage rates were over 8%, Bill Clinton was president, Brad Pitt married Jennifer Aniston, and vice versa, I might add, and Apple Computer was worth a measly $15 billion, a mere 0.5% of its current value. Now, a $500,000 30-year mortgage would have cost about $1,972 a month at the 2.8% mortgage rate available in early 2021. That's principal and interest. Today, with a 7.9 average rate, that payment would be $3,488. That's a 77% increase. More than 100,000 Americans have taken out mortgages last year, and this with an interest rate above 8%. That's according to Black Knight, whose spokesperson said, we expect that number to continue to press higher in the coming weeks. The high mortgage rates are painful for anybody wanting to buy a house, and mortgage brokers have very little business at the moment. New applications are at their lowest level since 1996. The non-housing economy saw much smaller increases in rates. For a big company like Apple, the yield on its 10-year bonds increased by about 3.2 percentage points since December 2021. The 30-year mortgage rate has risen 4.6 points over the same time period. At the same time, most homeowners in the U.S. continue to happily sit on mortgages with rates below 4%. Now, in the Fed's ideal soft landing scenario, its rate hiking campaign would slow down isolated areas of the economy while keeping the rest of corporate America going relatively strong. As such, Fed policymakers, they're likely to be perfectly happy with 8% mortgages for now. Housing and banking officials, and especially would-be buyers, not so much. They were just about out of time in this first segment, but we'll start this story. The restaurant industry is kind of coming back. Employment levels in food services finally creeping past February 2020 levels. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we get back from this break. Please stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie and hurt you.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. Also, look us up on the web at dgscoins.com. That's dgscoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs. They're informative. They're somewhat interesting, too, if I must say so myself, as a regular author, but we also provide Doug Nolan's weekly blog, and Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs has a weekly column of the current events, health-wise. Right before the break, we were talking about the restaurant industry kind of being back. Employment levels are still below their pre-pandemic trend. According to one economist, Julia Pollack at ZipRecruiter, were it not for the pandemic, employment would be more than a million higher. That's a lot. Prior to 2020, she says, the industry was growing at an exceptional pace, but the disruptions of COVID were monumental. And when restaurants shut down in 2020, millions, literally, of employees were laid off, displaced. When they reopened, many restaurants had a hard time finding nearly enough workers because a lot of those workers had moved on to other industries. And dining out has changed since then, too. The shift to remote work has disrupted dining out patterns. Lunchtime is now a lot different in a lot of downtowns, particularly in larger cities. And other customers' habits are shifting, too. Limited service restaurants, think fast casual, have seen growth. Employment there rose by about 117,000 between February 2020 and, last month, according to the government. But full-service restaurants have seen employment fall by 212,000 over the same time period. Bottom line, Pollack says, given all the disruptions, the industry recovery is almost miraculous. It's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Today's topic is, I guess, if you got it, well, why not flaunt it? Sooner or later, every parent asks Christopher Rim the same question. What will it take to get my kid into Harvard? or Yale? His answer? Try $750,000. That's RIM's going rate for advice on landing a coveted spot in the Ivy League for students who want to start their college prep in seventh grade. Price is more than twice what it can actually cost to attend 4 years at one of those eight elite schools. But for those who can pay, RIM and his team at New York-based Command Education serve as, well, a sort of white glove college concierge service. They call themselves mentors who will groom an overachiever, prod a slacker, fine-tune a B-plus here or an A-minus there, curate extracurriculars, and otherwise buff a high school resume to a high Princetonian gloss. Elite universities have long been stocked with children of the wealthy, but as admissions mania spirals and spirals out of control, in my humble opinion, only about 3% of applicants now get into Harvard these days. The ultra-wealthy, as a result, they're taking the win-at-all-costs games to new heights. Enter a new wave of luxury college consulting services that all but guarantee its clients will get into one of their dream schools. All-inclusive packages, not just for spring break anymore. These sometimes costing well into the six figures can start prepping kids before they even enter high school. RIM, who happens to be 28 years old, says money is no object for our clients. Frankly, he adds, if they never have a job or go to college, they're going to live better than most people anyway. What we're doing is building motivation for students that have every resource. Well, it's hardly news that wealthy parents try to buy every edge for their kids when they can, but the new class of high-end consultants, I think McKinsey and Company for 17-year-olds, is more evidence of the lengths to which people will go to gain access to these elite institutions. The Varsity Blues admission scandal a few years ago showed how, for some anyway, that can include breaking the law and spending a little time behind bars. The backdrop for all this, of course, is the age-old anxiety about getting into their college of choice. College application process has gotten murkier in recent years as acceptance rates plummet and parents search for anything that can give their kids an advantage. And even as millions struggle with student debt and debate grows about the cost of going to college, being accepted at an Ivy or another top-tier school remains an important status symbol, especially for wealthy students and their families. How crazy has this gotten? Well, RIM says a parent at New York's Trinity School, that's a private $64,000 a year Ivy League prep school, once offered him $1.5 million if he would agree not to work with any of his child's classmates. Well, RIM declined, thankfully, but boy, that's pretty amazing. Except you. Another college consulting company once received a call from one anxious father-to-be. The man had just learned that his wife was pregnant and wanted to inquire about hiring a consultant. According to the Accept U's co-founder and chief operating officer, Steve Friedfeld, a study released in July by a group of economists at Harvard found that children from families in the top 1% were 43% more likely to be admitted than students from the middle class. And those from the top 0.1% were more than twice as likely to get in. But hey, if you're cash strapped because of the economy or whatever, at New York-based firm Ivywise, founded 25 years ago, programs to guide students and anxious parents through the college application process start at just $28,000. There you go, an affordable alternative, ladies and gentlemen, and that is this week's Levity is Golden. Hey, the draw of bargains, you bargain shoppers, it may be fading. As three of the nation's biggest retailers kick off a key sales week, today, former Walmart U.S. CEO Bill Simon warns that consumers are starting to buckle for the first time in a decade. It's only a matter of time. He's blaming a list of headwinds weighing on consumers, particularly inflation, also higher interest rates, federal budget wrangling, polarized politics, and student loan repayments. And now new global tensions connected to violence in Israel. Simon noted yesterday that sort of pileup wears on a consumer and makes them wary. And for the first time in a long time, there's a reason for the consumer to actually pause. The timing comes as Amazon begins its two-day Prime Big Deal Days sale today. Walmart and Target are trying to compete with their own sales events to get an early jump on this year's holiday shopping season. Simon observes the retailers have one glaring thing in common. The bargains they're offering are not as deep as before. Simon says they usually say 50-inch TV is $199 or something like that. And now they say 50-inch TV is 40% off. He adds that you use percentages when you're not really proud of your price points. He says, I think you've got inflation pushing the relative price points upward. Well, shares of Amazon, Walmart, and Target are all under pressure over the past 2 months. Target is performing the worst of the three, down 19% before today. Simon, who sits on the boards of Darden Restaurants and Hanes, believes Walmart has a big advantage over its competitors right now. It's solely because of, yes, the food business. They're going to have both the eyeballs and the food traffic to probably have a better Christmas than maybe their competitors because of the food they offer. I'll see. This kind of disturbing story. Several federal law enforcement agencies apparently haven't properly been training their staffs on how to use facial recognition technology, or they've imposed policies to protect the public civil rights when it's used, according. That is, they haven't imposed the policies, according to the U.S. Government Accounting Office. Or accountability office, as it's now known. Facial recognition technology is being used increasingly by federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies, and it's led to a number of false arrests across the country, largely of black men and women, according to reports. The technology has also been faulted for failing to accurately identify black and brown people and others with dark skin tones. Even so, police, retail stores, airports, and sports arenas are rapidly turning to the technology. Some local governments that initially restricted its use are weighing whether to ease those limits because of jumps in crime. Last year, a black man was jailed in Georgia for nearly a week after facial recognition system incorrectly matched his face with a suspect in a New Orleans robbery, according to his lawyer. The man, who said he's never been to Louisiana, was reportedly released after detectives realized the mistake. Now, the recent report by the GAO found that from October 2019 to March last year, 2022, the FBI, DEA, Customs and Border Protection, Homeland Security investigations, and three other agencies used facial recognition for criminal probes without requiring staff training. Only three agencies, Homeland Security, the Marshal Service, and the Secret Service, had policies or guidance for using the technology that specifically addressed civil rights and civil liberties. The Secret Service actually largely halted its use of facial recognition in April 2020. The GAO also found that six agencies cumulatively conducted about 60,000 photo searches without having the proper training in place. The latest facial recognition surveillance technology is designed to identify people seen on security cameras in real time or close to it. It aims to match security camera footage with publicly available image, like police mugshots or social media profiles tied to that person's identity. The Department of Homeland Security, which is, you know, the umbrella department over a number of intelligence agencies plans to finalize a department-wide civil rights policy tied to facial recognition by this December. The Justice Department, which oversees the FBI and other agencies, has taken steps to issue a department-wide policy, but has faced delays, it says, in part because of a lack of funding. Hey, in a related story, if corporate CEOs had their own way, their workers would be back in the office and pursuing AI advancements at the same time. As workforces are changing, well, of course, so is technology and executive demands. A new survey conducted by KPMG finds that bosses are actually giddy about AI. 72% of U.S. CEOs say generative artificial intelligence is a top investment priority. They see it as a longer-term investment. Almost two-thirds say they expect a return in 3 to 5 years, while only one-quarter expect a return in 1 to 3 years. Now, the big question of whether promised efficiencies will translate into fewer jobs does remain a concern for many. Meanwhile, CEOs want people to be applying those skills in the office. In the survey, 62% said they envision their staff working permanently at the office within 3 years, almost double the 34% of a year ago. And support is waning for corporate involvement in advocacy around many of the country's biggest hot-button social issues. That's according to a new Public Affairs Council survey. No business wants to become a political football ahead of the 2024 election. Corporate affair leaders wary becoming another Disney or Anheuser-Busch or Target are looking for more perspective when wading into these big policy issues. Companies that advocate or implement policies in favor of, say, abortion access and a pathway to citizenship are much more likely to experience backlash than those that focus on environmental and sustainability efforts, according to the survey. Last year, two-thirds of Americans approved of major companies being involved in ending racial discrimination. This year, 57% support those efforts. And public backing for corporate engagement around abortion fell from 41 to 36%. Businesses, we know, remain one of the most trusted sources for news of information, although that trust is waning overall, trailing only friends and family members, according to the report. Companies and corporate affairs leaders are looking for ways to carry out their environmental, social, and governance priorities without getting stuck in crosshairs. Overseas, even as its domestic economy falters, China, touting its 10-year-old Belt and Road Initiative as an alternative model for economic development, it's just released a government report that praises its program while glossing over criticism that it saddled poor countries with too much debt they can't afford. The BRI program, championed by Chinese dictator for life Xi Jinping, has financed construction of ports, power plants, railroads, and other projects around the particularly developing world. Its foreign ministry said over the past 10 years, the fruitful results of building the Belt and Road together and the growing circle of friends have fully proved that the Belt and Road Initiative does not engage in a closed and narrow circle and creates a new paradigm of international cooperation. It was launched 10 years ago. The Belt and Road Initiative has backed projects carried out mostly by Chinese construction companies financed by loans from Chinese development banks. I hear that music. It means once again we're heading into a very short break. Please stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival. Don't say I gotta know if your sweet love is gonna save me. We've
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody off today, taking care of other business. You know where to get her, 1-800-375-4188. In today's first segment, we talked about how mortgage rates are heading to 8%, the highest in decades. Well, the main reason that mortgage rates are so high is simply because long-term interest rates are high. But the main reason mortgage rates are so much higher than other long-term rates is that U.S. mortgages, well, they can be prepaid without penalty. And prepayability is generally great for homeowners because it gives them the ability to refinance whenever rates come down. By the same token, however, it's bad for lenders who are now charging a lot more money to cover their prepayment risk. Most lenders make windfall profits. In fact, when rates go down, the value of the loans on their books goes up, and they can be sold for much greater than face value. Mortgage, however, don't necessarily work that way. The minute rates come down by a point or two, homeowners tend to refinance, paying back the loan only at its face value. The higher interest rate rises, the greater they can fall, and the greater the risk that lenders will see a sudden halt to the interest payments they have been promised for many years to come. Wendy Edelberg and Noadia Steinmetz-Silber of the Brookings Institute have an excellent explanation of the different components that make up the roughly 3 percentage point gap between 10-year Treasury rates and the 30-year mortgage rates. The so-called primary secondary spread, that's basically the amount that mortgage originators keep for themselves to cover their costs and profits, is well within normal levels of about 1.1 percentage points. But there's also duration risk, which is related to the fact that a typical mortgage lasts for 7 years rather than a 10-year treasury. If 7-year rates are higher than 10-year rates, that will increase the spread between mortgage rates and the 10-year treasury. Right now, however, that gap is tiny, just 1/100th of a point. The big increase has come in prepayment risk, which currently stands at 1.1 points. That's double its level at the beginning of this year. Mortgage rates are also being elevated by the fact that some of the biggest buyers of mortgage bonds have just dropped out of the market. Bottom line, well, you could take out an adjustable rate mortgage instead. Hey, the world is in a major hunger crisis, and private corporations are reaping the benefit. Largest food trading companies have the status of oligopolies, and have become unregulated financial institutions. That's according to a blistering 29-page chapter of the 2023 UN's Trade and Development Report called Food Commodities, Corporate Profiteering, and Crises. The two authors note the profits of four major food traders rise during periods of market volatility and during food crises. More than 345 million people around the world are facing high levels of food insecurity this year. That's a rise of 200 million people from before the pandemic. Private companies can't necessarily solve that problem. I'll tell you, their unprecedented profits do seem extremely distasteful at best. Our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. It features Doug Nolan's weekly Credit Bubble Bulletin blog and puff carrier Wendy Wilson's provocative food for thought column on 3D printed food of the future. Plus, I have part two of my four-part series on deficits and debt. The U.S. Constitution, adopted in 1787, established that the new nation was a unified or common market with no internal tariffs or taxes on interstate commerce, certainly not on income. The extent of federal power was much debated, with Alexander Hamilton taking a very broad view as the first Secretary of the Treasury during the administration of our first president, George Washington. Hamilton successfully argued for the concept of implied powers, where the Constitution authorized federal government to create anything, necessary to support its contents, even if it wasn't specifically noted in it, like the ability to build lighthouses at the time. He succeeded in building strong national credit based on taking over the state's debts and bundling them with the old national debt and the new security sold to wealthy individuals. Those colonists, in turn, now had an interest in keeping the new government solvent so they could be paid. Hamilton funded the debt with tariffs on imported goods and a highly controversial tax on whiskey. Remember that whiskey rebellion? He believed the U.S. should pursue economic growth through diversified shipping, manufacturing, and banking. He actually sought and achieved congressional authority to create the first Bank of the United States in 1791. That charter lasted until 1811. After the Revolutionary War, cities over time restored their economic basis. Newer cities seeing growth included smaller places like Salem, Massachusetts, which actually opened new trade with China, New London, Connecticut, and Baltimore, Maryland, which eventually grew larger. After the first bank was created, new local banks were formed and began to flourish. Merchant entrepreneurship flourished during this period and was a powerful engine of prosperity of the era. During the War of 1812, Britain and France cut off imports to the U.S., which had the unintended consequences of encouraging the eventual rise of American manufacturing. First Appropriations Act, passed by the new Congress, was signed into law by President Washington on September 29, 1789. This act set a budget of, listen to this, $639,000 to cover the new government's expenses for that year, an estimated 0.3% of the young nation's pre-industrial, mostly agrarian-based gross domestic product. To compare, in fiscal year 2023, preliminary results show that government spending exceeded $6.4 trillion, around 24% of GDP, leading to a deficit of roughly $1.6 trillion. The nation's gross national debt has grown from a Revolutionary War-driven $71.1 million as of 1/1/1790 to an astounding $33.17 trillion on September 30th. After the adoption of the U.S. Constitution, the government owed roughly $11 million to foreigners, mostly to Dutch bankers and the French government, and about $42 million to domestic creditors. But the original 13 states also had accumulated a ton of debt while fighting the British and others, which federal government assumed in 1790, adding to its load. Beginning with the government's fiscal year in 1789 and continuing through 1849, the annual budget averaged actually a surplus of $1.16 billion, that is in nominal dollars, then current dollars. Over the next 50 years, especially with War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, plus numerous other conflicts with Native Americans and other countries, the federal budget started averaging annual deficits of $20 million. All told, from 1800 to 1849, the annual federal budgets produced 33 surpluses and 17 deficits. But over the next five decades, from 1850 to 1899, the government reported a surplus in 36 years and a deficit in 14. After that, budget balances were upended and deficits became far more common, occurring in 70 years of the 20th century with surpluses in the other 30, averaging a net deficit of $36.3 billion a year. Now, of course, over that span of time, the nation was embroiled in two world wars, the Korean and Vietnam Wars, the first Gulf War, plus several smaller skirmishes, and built up an overkill arsenal of nuclear weapons at the same time. Plus, major social programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid came online during this period with a multitude of tax credits, tax expenditures, and tax cuts. The government has managed to run a surplus, in fact, in just 2 years since 2000 and 9 years since 1950, four of them coming during the second term of the Clinton presidency after the grand bargain with Newt Gingrich and a Republican Congress. In the new millennium, average annual net deficits, including the two surpluses, have been $847 billion. All the excess spending and shortage of revenue has piled up over $33 trillion in debt, more than what was spent over the first 182 years of the Republic through just 1970. Although both gross debt and debt held by the public are important measures, most economists regard debt held by the public, particularly as a share of GDP, to be the most economically meaningful measure of debt. The largest portion of the national debt measures the amount of U.S. debt held by entities other than the federal government and traded publicly. Economists say it's relevant for understanding the extent to which debt is providing fiscal stimulus, crowding out private investment, influencing interest rates, and consuming fiscal space, like interest payments on the debt. Gross federal debt has also some significance as one measure of the government's total obligations in a given year. With some minor adjustments, gross debt is also used to calculate when the government has or will hit the legal national debt limit. Now, the $26.5 plus trillion of debt held by the public are owned as follows: 30% by foreign entities, 50% by private and domestic and public domestic entities, and 20% held by the Federal Reserve. The Fed significantly expanded its treasury holdings during the pandemic and subsequent economic crisis that began in 2020. Foreign entities include a mixture of non-U.S. individuals, businesses, banks, and governments. The $8 trillion of foreign-held debt comprises this: 15% or $1.1 trillion is held by Japan, 12% or $869 billion is held by China, The Eurozone holds a combined 18%, $1.4 trillion. UK, Belgium, and Luxembourg each hold $329 to $705 billion. And OPEC plus member nations together hold about 3%, or $256 billion. Roughly $12 trillion of domestic holdings not held by the Fed. Most are held by the financial sector. For example, mutual funds hold 20%, state and local governments 14%, depository institutions hold 13%, private pension funds hold 4%, insurance companies 3%, and owners of saving bonds sold directly by the Treasury Department hold 2%. The other 38% is held by other investors like households, non-financial businesses, and government-sponsored enterprises. Now, most of the $6.8 trillion in intragovernmental debt is held in government trust funds. $2.7 trillion held in the Social Security Old Age and Survivors Insurance Trust Fund. $1.4 trillion is in the DoD Military Retirement Fund. $985 billion in the Civil Service Retirement and Disability Trust Fund. $354 billion in the DoD Medicare Eligible Retiree Fund, $200 billion in the Medicare Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, $193 billion in the Medicare Supplemental Medical Insurance Trust Fund, $142 billion in the Social Security Disability Insurance Trust Fund, $118 billion in the Highway Trust Fund, $81 billion in the Deposit Insurance Fund, the FDIC, and another $710 billion in other federal agency funds. Analysts like the National Taxpayers Union Foundation's Demian Bradley believe as budget deficits reach increasingly higher levels, they are more likely to become an albatross around the neck of a future generation of taxpayers. And that burden will come in the form of higher taxes, higher interest payments on an ever-growing beanstalk of debt, and slower economic growth, all leading to a diminished quality of life for our children and theirs. Hey, stay tuned for next week's third installment of Deficits and Debt, when we'll look ahead a few decades to see where key forecasters see deficits and debt going and how our quality of life will be affected. Hint, they won't be going any lower. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow with Wendy Wilson for Pop Carriers. Thanks, as always, to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.